Okay, this is breakdancing rhyme. A beautiful cup of tea for me, reflecting, digesting without a pause, my failure to honour the breakdance call. Why did I start this at all? Head spins and windmills are not such a thrill as you would think while looking in. The truth is that the answer haunts me, addicted to the TV at 40, a hazy, lazy mind of restricted, convicted to the easy chair of those who sit and stare, those who appear without their care, but underneath are full of fear. And tears to these people rarely come, and boredom stiffens up their bum until they can no longer have fun. Struck dumb in the face of youth, the truth, the awful appall, they've wasted their chance to learn and swirl about the truth, or bend our rhyme, or wisely spend our time. This is a shadow that dances over my mind, sometimes unkind. So until I find my mission here, I resolve to bend and rhyme and spend some time in the shade of my mind and spinning literally on and in my head.
Thank you, Anna. And next up we have Jennifer Matthews.
The first one I'm reading, I've been working on for a while, and I'm actually going to send it off to a contest, which if you want the details, I'll give them to you later, but it's due Friday, but big prize money. Anyways, I'm great for taking constructive criticism, so if you have any kind of feedback for me so I can really rush this revision, that would be great. Thanks. it's called Isaac the Lamb. The father of nations is poised with God's voice, a blade. His coming message, my chest, words made flesh. I breathe, no rounds yet. I'm father's kindling, tied in a bare bundle, the sticks, toothy points, biting into my tender meat. A starved angel announces a menu change. Animal blood instead. A warm hug, next, slaughter. I wonder who will be feasting. Father is serving father. And the discussion group is resuming next week at 8 o'clock. So for those of you who ask me, why don't we read anyone that we know of? I have some Dylan Thomas for you, right? But I also have somebody you probably know, Pablo Neruda. And I'm just going to read you this poem to kind of entice you to come discuss him with me at 8 o'clock. Okay. And the Neruda poem is called Clenched Soul. We have lost even this twilight. No one saw us this evening hands in hands while the blue night dropped on the world. I have seen from my window the fiesta sunset in the distant mountain tops. Sometimes a piece of sun burns like a coin in my hand. I remembered you with my soul clenched in that sadness of mine that you know. Where were you then? Who else was there? Saying what? Why will the whole of love come on you suddenly when I am sad and feel you are far away? The book fell that always closed at twilight. And my blue sweater rolls like a hurt dog at my feet. Always, always you recede through the evenings towards the twilight erasing statues. Okay. If you want to go for this question, just wave at me and I'll give it to you.
So you have copies, Jen, of the poems, do you think? Jen has copies of those poems. And next up we have Mary O'Connell.
This is actually a song. I hope you bear with me. It's called Bye Bye to a Sterling Guy. Bye-bye, Bertie, bye-bye. Paul, he said you were sly. Devious and cunning was words that he used. Your ego was bruised, and we are so confused. There's got Gronya Carouse to tell all of the truth. Your hopes were dashed, sterling was cashed. All of us keep wondering just where it is stashed. Bertie, when will we know? That's why you had to go. Michael Wall was a friend. Where was he in the end? As the plasterer came to your aid, gave you a spade. Good God, the hole you made. Satan suited you fine. You chose Bath over wine. You knew Healy Ray would back you to stay. The rest of the invertebrates are waiting for me. Man was your Waterloo. Time to bid you adieu.
See you, Bertie. Next up to the mic, we have Patrick Carter.
There was Alison O'Leary from Greg Road, who couldn't stop chewing on her own hair. Long, mousy strands, so coarse and so abundant, no one noticed the absence of hundreds from her scalp. Though naturally sinuous, their long weight pulled them straight. They curled up in her belly like a nest of indigestible vermicelli, blocking all passage of food, so she died. Then there was a nameless girl from Pierce Road, joyous on her honeymoon in Mallorca, 1971, an early chartered flight, who unwittingly ate an exotic rosé-tinged lettuce head with a raw reptilian egg concealed in its layers of organic tull. In a trimester it hatched inside her, a creature replete with teeth, 4 feet with claws, which gnawed away at her insides as it grew from the size of a worm, so she died. A sad little girl near the lock played all alone at shop, with blue mussel shells for banknotes, and on her vegetable stall, dewberries, stingless nettles, leaves of dock, and digitalis. As her own customer, she sucked the sweet red flesh from the yew fruit before spitting away the poisonous kernels. Of all the leaves, digitalis seemed least bitter and most crisp, with white and lilac blossoms capping each of her digits, except her toes. She ate wads of the greenery until her heart stopped, or so it goes. There are more people walking the earth now than buried in the ground, or dust in the air, or salt in the sea. More people than bread, more people than rice. So many more people, there are not enough past lives to go around. Being middle-aged, lucky enough to survive the great flu epidemic of the late 60s, I arrived before the Maasai started wearing t-shirts or the tribes of the Amazon saw an empty Coke can. Before countless unnamed species went extinct, I had 3 undistinguished past lives. And unlike most Chinese, I have many siblings, not just now, but in the past, and in new incarnations. A charlatan in Switzerland claims one can acquire a past life halfway through your present. You pay him a fortune, pray at a certain Orion-connected temple, and acquire the spirit of the recently deceased. Some people are rich and stupid enough to do this more than once. People have started willing their past lives to their mistresses, and their grandchildren. In rural areas of Japan, where nonagenarians are as common as soybeans, murders have increased ninefold. The killers are city young people with more religious fervor than souls. Still, no one knows what a past life is actually for.
Thank you, Pat. And next up we have Mr. Jerry O'Neill.
I'm afraid this isn't a poem, it's pure doggerel, and I dedicate it to Chris down there, who doesn't write doggerel, but he's drinking very healthily Ballygowan, and the subject of this song is mineral water. And there are some of you here who are probably much too young to remember the time when the idea of selling water in bottles would have been looked on as completely crazy. And when they were first introduced on the market, they were looked on as sort of pretentious yuppie drinks, but they're all basically the numbers because we have to the ordinary tap water is, but anyway. It was. Oh, come on, you lads and lassies now. By the way, this is traditional doggerel, and that has to start off the line. Oh, come on, you lads and lassies now, who are out on the spree in search of crack and action on the banks of the Lee. If you venture into Strongbow's bar, my advice, it may sound strange, but don't dare to ask for water and be sure to check your change. For the Normans came to Shandon, and there they set up camp. They built a town from butter, and they placed it on a swamp. Some made their riches selling wine, and Barry selling tea. But Strongbow made his lucre selling water for a fee. For it was Christmas time in 88, when planes fell from the skies. I paid 5 quid at Strongbow's door to hear the flack cowboys. And then I drank my fill of pints of stout till I could drink no more. So I thought I'd better call a halt, on my head this would be sore. So I beckoned to the barman, saying, I've had enough of stout. Could I have a glass of water, please, to rinse the system out? But he clunked a bottle on the bar, and reaching for the till, with a glass of ice and lemon, he proffered me a bill. I said, hold on there a minute, boy. Oh, what the hell is this? It's water from the tap I want, and not that yuppie tip. Oh, what did my mates think of me? I'd never live it down, sure I'd rather drink Budweiser than be seen with Ballygowan. But the barman said, I'm sorry, sir, but nothing here is free. Even for the old tap water, I must charge you 90p. A long time ago with inflation, it'd be a lot more expensive. Now I've drank in bars in the water funds from Bangkok to New York. But I was never charged for H2O till I arrived in Cork. Now they don't sell sand on the hot Sudan, nor sunshine in the south of Spain. So how can you charge for water in this land of constant rain? Then up stepped two men in dicky bowls. They were 6 foot tall or more. And they roughly dragged me down the stairs and they thrown me out the door. Humiliated and dejected, I stood in the pouring rain, and with fantasies of water I composed a sad refrain. Oh, the River Lee, a sainted stream that comes from Gugunbarra, it wends its way to Roche's Point by way of Inniscarra. It flows right under Strongbow's bar, and he pumps it up for free. But he'll not give you a drop of it unless you part with 93. Now Strongbow is a gombine, he's a multi-millionaire, from patenting a system for to bottle pure fresh air. An aspiring politician, he's a councillor of note, he'll promise you free water if you promise him your vote. And now Strongbow's a good Catholic, so he went to see the Pope, And then he stole some holy water up for sure he is no dope. And though Strongbow's been twice married, he hasn't a son nor a daughter, for any time he does the deed, he comes with pure spring water. And now Strongbow sits in his county house, where he's counting every penny. He'll be counting still when he's down in hell, but he'll not have enough money. Then he'll offer all his money from his last pound to his first, for one thimbleful of water, for to soothe his raging thirst. But the devil will reply to him with a patronizing frown, "I'm sorry, sir, but in this bar we don't sell belly gowns." So come all you lads and lassies who are out on the spree in search of crack and action on the banks of the Lee. If you venture into Strongbow's bar, my advice, it may sound strange, but don't dare to ask for water. Be sure to check your chips.
Next up, we have someone from the other side of the world. He's always from somewhere, I'm not sure where he's. At the moment he's from Germany. Mr. Matthew Sweeney.
I wrote this poem recently in Germany from some things I saw there. It's quite disturbing what young people are starting to do in the world. Before I left Cork, there was some horrible shit in Dublin, where two Polish guys were killed with screwdrivers, and that really got me going. And the Americans have a term for this, they call it thrill kill. The last day of summer. They hung the cat at dawn on the last day of summer. They chorused out a dirge when it stopped kicking. Then all together flung their bottles out into the lake. Miko held up a hand lacerated by the cat's claws, as if it was a trophy. They snapped it with their mobile, allowing him alone to punch the swinging cord. "What now?" bellowed Heike. "It's a baby of a day. Tomorrow we disperse across this great big land. Let's have a morning to light up the winter evening." "We agree," said the giant twin. "Let's kill someone." A gust of laughter shook the dangling feline as an elderly jogger in a red tracksuit hove into view. Dr. Quincy's Pleasure Emporium. "Yes, I can see you," said the dwarf, swinging from his chandelier, flicking out his long orange hair as I lay under the leopard skin sofa, entangled with a purple-eyed nymph. A peacock uttered its long, harsh cry, which ricocheted off the round mirror encased in a copper ring, causing me to curse and wriggle out, abandoning the nymph who rolled up into a ball and whimpered as a white crow flew round my head, then zipped off, calling me to follow into a yellow room where a piper spun webs of green and blue, and my nymph swirled with the dwarf, whose orange echoed the leaping flames of the log fire, in front of which Dr. Quincy swayed in a hammock, sipping brandy, stroking the now quiet peacock, who suddenly laid an egg that was gold.
Thank you.
That's it after that one. Thanks, Matthew. I'm only joking. Next up we have Mr. Aaron Lewis. Aaron.
Weekend was, and so I wrote a poem about it. How is your weekend? Intensive. Beetroot foot massage and tip-tap ding of her typewriter. Romantic confessions and rhythms of art that allow the universal moment to sing out. Raw chickpeas and orange elf shoes make the cycle home more inspiring. Blue moon movies, poetic reestimation and loving energies of life. Snatch, Shakespeare, unicycles, orphanages in Bulgaria encompass my lyrical delivery. Let's have an orange, you'll feel better. Photographs manifest the fastest bike ride in months. The jazzy blue beat in Bird Avenue. Political ideals overcome my poetic sensibilities. I let loose, I sing, I play out my rhythm and enjoy my love of life now. On a Monday morning, in here now, we do a poetry or a creative writing workshop with a guy called Adam Wyatt from England, and he gets us to do various exercises. Today was really interesting. He cut up a poem, he cut all the words out of this poem and then got us to rearrange them and make a poem from the words that were in another poem. But we did another exercise a few months ago, and he gave us the list of quotations that we could use. We had to use each word in the quotation to write a line in the poem that we wrote ourselves. This is the poem. Life is a succession of moments. To live each one is to succeed. Life allows us to be free in a moment. Is it when we sing out our own song? A huge opportunity to show off your new hat. At last you say, with each succession of kings, we are the anointed ones. What is it that plays out the rhythms of nature? It's in a moment expression truly lived out. To truly be yourself and follow your own soul, that is to live. Each and every day we exalt in our own chosen expression, one person to another. Is it the moment or the expression of it? What is it that we are truly about? To be still and truly know our own unique path, that is what it means to live and ultimately succeed. I did a drama course in January 2007, and there was a guy who came in who was an expert on Shakespeare, and he told us a story about a painter who went out with his easel one day in his paints, and he went for a walk, and while he was walking at the side of the road he saw a load of daffodils, and he decided that all he was going to do was paint this daffodil that he saw. So he sat down and he painted this daffodil. And he showed his friends the daffodil, and they were amazed by it. And like, wow, this is so beautiful. So in turn, his friends painted the daffodil that he painted, and then they showed their friends, and in turn, they painted the daffodil that they painted, and then they took the original painting and corresponded it with the last painting, and it looked nothing like the original painting. It's the daffodil. and the guide said, you must choose your own daffodil. So that's an introduction to this poem. I'm going to dedicate this poem to Derek, who is a person who I met on the drama course. So, let your heart seep out its wisdom. Take your chances when they come. Crystal stars shine in the blackness of night. An ocean of worlds collecting together in the abyss. Go at your own pace. Choose your own daffodil. Paint it. Let tears wash your face and feed your soul. The hands that make the bread with loving tenderness that cradles the baby in swaddling fabrics. Sloth, an animal of beingness and rich care, notices the sudden moments that echo out in a memory of trees. With your eyes, be a witness to the changing fortunes of time. Take care in your steps. It's later than you think. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. Next up to the open mic, we have Mr. Seamus Harrison.
Thanks, Paul. Bluebird. For over 3 years, his own record stood, since Dumbleyung. Now he's on Coniston water once more, a weather window at last. The very first leg, level and flat, sheer thrust, jetting red hot up on her planing points. 250 plus 47, over. So awfully close. Just three to go. Sea anchors bite, around again, no turning back, no extra fuel, the bravest of the brave. That raucous roar, they gasp and point at the tramping spray. None can glimpse the adrenaline rush on land or in water, the quickest of all. 320, a blur. She lifts, skipper, come in, over. He surely knew it was his own weight. Into the water barrier and beyond, his memorial stands on Pussycat Hill over Lake Dumbleyung. Pegasus. Parts merge to enchant. Then Zeus, he is gone in one lightning bolt. Blowtorch, sheet metal. Pre-dawn, I return to spot stars on his flanks, hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. The waiting. No word. 10 paces to the window. The harbour's mouth empty. Nothing but another vacant wave. Steeped against the edge, another silent gull. The phone, the only one for miles. Don't touch it. Surely no news is good news. But is it? When they're well overdue. Why no message? God damn it! No, sorry, they're only late. But supposing a leak, a foul propeller, maybe a ground. A radio shave. The heat. Fire. A sulfur whale in the pit prop. Gas explosion. Broken seacock. Rudder, stop it. What's the time? Pump jammed. Man overboard. A rusty mine. Poor faithful. The bay window. Binoculars. Black point. Bleaker. Blacker. Yes, the wireless. No, leave that sweatshirt. It's fresher now. The swell more lumpy. The broken cliffs more brittle. I know. Water and the fuel. That was a steeper trough than the upturning hulk. the first cold plunge of panic of the half-tide rock. Blasted to hell, the orange fender slips down the plank of sky to grapple with the hull, an azure hull, with a list rolling her red underbelly and losing buoyancy, losing stability, like me. Yes, I can nearly taste the salt. The seascape fades to grey muck. Shiver. No, no, not fog. The Christian June. Caught in two, lost with all hands. Admit it, they are overdue. Tears spilled from waterproof eyepieces. The blinking mist clears. Thanks, to you. The sea can be a good friend. Tractor growls outside, but a bad master. A marsh clatter of teeth. Pray now, pray for God's sake.
Thank you, Seamus. Next up to the mic, third time to a vote. Going to give us some Shakespeare, I think. Much for a change. Mr. Derek Shannon.
I think it's better just so you can hear me good, you know? Okay, this is from King Lear. It's a piece where he's on the mountain and he's feeling a little bit of stress. So, you just need to get into character. International Poetry Festival, the White House Slam, and he's been shortlisted for a World Spiritual Poetry Collection. Mr. Donal O'Shichon.
I don't know how time goes. It's a bit frightening to realize here tonight that when I ran the poetry sessions at the Harlequin, maybe half of the people here haven't even stopped at school, never mind writing poetry. Robert Finn's gone too, Davitt, Sean Dunn, Greg Dinanti, people like that. People like that that are that it's only here tonight. You don't miss these things for long, but it's only here tonight that you know, you just realize the attrition time has caused. I came from a funeral today actually where somebody in their early 60s, mother, grandmother, that have fought for every moment of life against cancer, and when you compare that to lives thrown away carelessly every weekend, no need to introduce this poem, the theme that would be familiar to all of you. Full of laughter and banter, I watch them prepare for a night in the town, infused with the confidence of youth, confident, assertive, joking as to how many pints they could get down between time of their arrival and closing. Another had the final plans for his new housing. Over the days, weeks and months, I'd watched it collect from line, drawing and sketch on his uncle's dining room table, discussed rooms and spaces with him, delighted that he was able, a few short months after 20, to bankroll into reality what at his time in my generation would have been beyond our dreams and aspirations. 4 hours later in a hospital bed, hovering between life and death, gulping tanked oxygen, he fought for each ragged breath. His friend's laughter stilled haunts the hospital corridor, screened the face of nurse and doctor after each medical examination, overheard conversations relayed in whispered urgent conversation, possible kidney and liver failure, possible damage to his brain, subdued and shocked, and yet the penny had not dropped. Fuck's sake, what was it anyway? Just a few extra lines of cocaine. And in his crowded hospital room, I see the doctor's arm reach over for a brief moment, his finger on the switch that ended life support. But by then the last rites had been rendered, and our final farewell said. For days we had hoped against hope, but knew all that had been that final life was already dead. The weekend before last, a woman that had helped build a Celtic Tiger like more of her generation and deserved better was left in her own urine and excrement for 60 hours in a hospital trolley. And no matter what talk is done about it, we've supposed to have more Mercedes cars per head of population than Germany, more millionaires in Dublin per head of population than London, but yet it's the same as food going out to the port of Cork while people starve during the famine, or the same we put up with TV or anything. It's not about resources, it's about attitude. Our president's younger brother, his throat sliced ear to ear, crawled 2 streets to his parents' door, trailing blood and fear. He should have died but lived, and like the thousands more, forgotten, unremembered, and spoken of no more. While southern commerce clinked the tills, and the chattering classes drank their wine, and went to theater and to party, and life for them stayed fine, just like their people's people of 40 years before, who scorned the wretched Magdalenes and Ireland's orphan poor, and left this world naked until the end of time, without excuse or reason for their appalling crime. While southern commerce clinked the tills, and the chattering classes drank their wine, and went to cater and to party, and life for them was fine. From the famine to the 40s, the Holocaust of TB took father, son, and mother, daughter, decimating family, and the clergy preached with God's own will, and the priest ate Horbidita Brown. In a decade, it was ended by the courage of Noel Brown. While southern commerce clinked the tills, and the chattering classes drank their wine, and went to theatre and to party, and life for them stayed fine. Now each day brings some new scandal, for corruption seldom walks alone. This time it is our elders, left with bedsores to the bone. While the PR men and pinstripes, with ready written smile, use the courts and constitution to buy greed another month or mile. While southern commerce clinks the tills, and the chattering classes drink their wine, and go to theatre and to party, and life for them is fine. I think about Jim Kimmy, and a voice that spoke the truth, yet here in Jim's own city hangs the silence of the mute, and things march on unchanging, and few things ever will, while the chattering classes have their wine, and commerce clinks the till.
Next up we have our resident converted barmaid, poet, Sabine McCauley.
This is a serious poem, so change for me, and it's a true story about my life. It seems to have some reasons to say, for this I do not know why. I have respected you, I have appreciated your laws, but it seems determined to seek my fear, for now I am afraid to cross you. You see, I have a fear of rogues and corns, as they have not been kind to me. As a child, I was in my first car accident, and so my phobia began. Years later, coming out of mass, when I was a good Catholic girl, I recall seeing the car approaching me. There was nothing I could do. Thump. I had just been reversed over outside the chapel by a man with a wooden leg. They told me to sue him, but I did not, as I thought he had enough hardship what with having the wooden leg. Several years passed. I was getting out of a car with a long open black coat. Slam. The door closed on my coat. The car accelerated. I tried to run along, but the speed was too fast. So I was dragged along the ground until I freed myself. So you can see where my fear stems from, and I'll never drive and I'll never be in the car alone. But with all my incidents with my enemy, I've never even broken a bone.
Thank you, Sidney. And next up we have Mr. O'Brien or Mukhu.
We meet again in the way we met before, sitting and letting go of expecting woes. And there you go again, bathing me in bliss, telling me what I forgot I already knew, that all there is to do is this. Under your seats, you will hear music and not money. We bust up the seats of life in search of this paper, ignoring the inner melody. Darkness cannot go on forever. Hello, how are you? And what do you do? I stand in front of the microphone and get really afraid. Hello, how are you? And what do you do? I sit and meditate. Hello, how are you? What is it that you do?
I see her. It's terrifying. It is terrifying. It's last call in the bar. If anybody would like a drink, now's the last time to buy one. It's fine. We've only got 9 people left on the open mic. It's an awful venue, this, huh? It's terrible spot for forever. No place for poetry. It's ridiculous. Next up to the open mic, we have Patricia Walsh.
Alright, thank you very much. This one is a horse in 1995. It's called Home. I have a house that's on the edge, and there I like to live. Little children come sometimes to try and push me a little bit closer to water. God despises those that really fear him. That's your unspoken truth. I've passed on so young and been passed by without any tribute, like Martin Scorsese on Channel 4. On Saturdays, I walk the time up and raise my funds. A long line of pennies reaching up to the sky and the house extension stretching out to sea. Think about it, thank you, miss. You're actually laughing. You're finally laughing at me. I have a castle in the air, and there I like to stagnate. Adolescents come sometimes and stay together forever in my books, push me farther away from home. Thank you. This was called Never Forgive Me. Never forgive me. I am still so alone, and nothing's arising from my working vein, regardless. Unchained, unindependent, overstrained. I know not my own mind, it's all disjointed. There are many versions, hypothesized, each giving a right answer. How do you know me? How do you understand the type of disinhibition that goes from nature? I don't drink anymore, I vow never to smoke. Outside there is danger, so gracious, so cold. Pulling doors open, and paying for drinks on all the table. I do not wish, in any big way, that you finally crawl away, and back to one you call a poison dish. Let your Christmas spirit aid the table. No offense to you or yours, but let it persist. One here is a poison chalice, and mine, how you look at her one twist of sweetness. She's off, you've done it. No need to remind any one of you how strong and Satan she is. If her heart is acting up in such a way, avoid her. Kill her within the limits of law and spirit that has guided her sweetness. Thank you.
And next up to the microphone we have Mr. Cliff Wedgbury.
Two pieces. The first piece is called Forest, and it comes from a time I used to belong many years ago to a group called Lobbyists, and we'd choose a subject and we have to come back the following week with a poem written on that subject. And the subject they chose was the destruction of rainforest. So I had this surreal idea about taking the last forest home before it was too late. Take this beautiful forest. It could be any, but let's take this one. Tall trees are waving their arms in the breeze. Observe spiders casting silver lines. Listen to lovers whispering through filtered sunlight. Find soft colours where birds and foxes make their homes. Find peace. After, take a group of men with a common aim, a few machines, and very soon you have an empty space. Later, take a beautiful forest. Quickly take this one, it may be the last. Put it under your coat, run all the way home, hide it in the attic. And tonight, when a group of men walk down your street, do not tremble. I will be your decoy and stand on the corner waving my arms in the breeze. Draw the curtains, they'll soon be gone. We may need you before too long. Oh yes, we may need you before too long. I'll try one of my Antarctic ballads. This is called The Ballad of Teddy Evans. Teddy Evans was Captain Scott's second in command, and he was a member of the last support party turned back by Scott 150 miles from the pole. And the last support party consisted of Teddy Evans, Bill Lashley and Tom Crean, and they were the last to see the polar men alive. At last support, Scott turned us back. Lashley, Crean and I, we gave them all three rousing cheers, not knowing they would die. Scott and Wilson, Birdie Bowers, Tap Evans, Captain Oates, with tears of envy, a good luck wish, a lump rose in our throats. We watched them go, those five brave men, to the pole through ice and snow. A southern haze consumed them all, and we turned ourselves to go. Retracing footsteps, falling sledge, to the north we marched again. But scurvy soon caught up with me, how I would limp in pain. Day by day, hour by hour, in agony I went, till I could trudge no further on. My life was all but spent. Leave me in the snow, I said, for this will be my grave. They shook their heads and disobeyed the order that I gave. Crean and Lashley placed me on the sledge and carried on. They pulled and hauled those icy miles until their strength was gone. With tired limbs they pitched the tent, placing me inside. Who would go and who would stay? I heard them both decide. Crean came in to say goodbye. I thanked that brave young man. As he marched into the wilderness, would I e'er see him again? 2 days had passed and I was sinking to my icy grave. Lashley now too weak to leave, too late himself to save. The hours passed and we both thought our fate was surely sealed. But he nursed me kindly with good heart, a man as true as steel. Then we heard when hope was lost, 2 dog teams in a race. The lead dog burst into the tent and licked my hand and face. Dimitri and the doctor came to save us just in time. Tom Crean had told them of our flight, his epic march so fine. Crean had hiked all 30 miles to Hut Point through the snow to save our skin, to fight and win where blizzard winds did blow. Let his name forever live where gallant men stand tall. He saved my life, that Kerry lad, from the hills near Arnold School.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad the South Pole has been conquered, that's where we're done with. We'll have to go through that all again, you know?
I'm just going outside.
Yeah. Oh, yes, it's okay. It's better now, isn't it?
One of the two successful villains now.
One Argus is the bishop and Antarctica there. Yeah.
All the rest
is
crap.
Very funny. You rested. Anyway. So all you Egypts, you did not come here on Argus, there is nothing. You're Egypt. Except we have one of the custodians of French for our part of the world. Great to have her, hopefully a guest bird in the future. Mary Nina.
Thank you, Paul. Okay.
I can't actually read this, so I pretend I can. Keep talking, babe. It was his wish to see me through a screen with words and music and a cast of dwarves playing card sharps, fire eaters, hecklers. My only act was to jabber, but I could work it up to a howl, and this I did for centuries. The beauty of my inflection was enough to catch the crowd, and when I had them, I'd lunge between whisper and rant, spinning on plosives. Sometimes, to keep myself warm, I'd do my dance at the one-legged crow, toppling against the glass, as walk-ons bared their teeth and catapulted me with pennies. Only the voice could stop me. Not now, but tomorrow. Keep talking, babe. Keep dancing. And I would do my questions, always the same. Is he near? Did he see me pinned? Did I suffer good? How do I turn off these eyes?
Mary actually came without any poetry tonight, and she wrote that from memory so that she could read it up here on the microphone. Yeah, not many people could do that. Except we have Anne-Marie Bramfield.
By the words we did, I can't remember on the 5th of days, that's Sunday actually. It is that Lord you gave me that propelled you of light, that kept those stars in the sky that made the ashes rise up. Oh my God, what a gift to get. You, with your ventriloquist waves, make me smile and burst into laughter. It was in that moment and in that time, as the dust settled, that I fell in love with you on the way.
That's Emery. Next up we have Mr. Joe Harding.
Read, I skip a line without thinking. I should have noticed those words. Just slow down. Take more heed of a comma, a semicolon, or a colon. Almost a barrier could slow you down to a full stop. That would be out of order. I could miss a connection somewhere in that simile. And what was that metaphor? There was a time when I played behind the wheel, could drive the rim of the world, put Odysseus in the hasty place, glide through cul-de-sacs and ride the clouds. Full stop did not exist then. That's that one. And forget Paul mentioned John McCartney tonight. I read his last book, and it was one of those books that you read. After reading the first page, you know it's an instant classic, and I'm reading one at the moment, and it's called Wildwood by, I think it's called Roger Deakin. And he says in it, the enemies of the woods are always the enemies of culture and humanity. And I came across that today. This thing is called the all-forgiving wood. If trees are beings, why do we kill them? We make appointments with them, take advantage of their silence, admire them almost like a woman, plant them, paint them, pray to them, take shelter in their bosoms, talk to them, even though they exasperate us with their indifference. Each tree holds a wealthy truth, a time-locked secret, and quite generous with their blessings, they will not answer. Neither will they tell us anything. Like the clouds, they hold authority, and still we kill them. We listen to the music of their leaves, even when the wind is only whispering, and know that God is talking to us. And when one dies of old age, it will keep us warm, and still we kill trees, so that books may be written about them. He who dishonors the oak, that mighty king, shall fall, and his ashes, that great misnomer, be scattered in a glorious, eternal, all-forgiving wood. Thank you.
Poets left the evening, which is fantastic. Just to remind you, I've got a little MP3 recorder going on here. The OVO website records the open mic session once a week. You can listen to it again. If you would like your piece excluded, just let me know and I'll make sure that it is. Okay. Next up to the open mic we have Mr. Gene Barry.
Hey.
First poem is called Prima Gravida. Or as you drive a four-wheel drive, Prima Gravida. You are the greatest, as the hunter's god, and the sun never looked on aught so grand, a port to dock, a place to pray, to wish. No Gothic horde will break this bond, or plunder dreams of Lydia and Alexander. He will maintain to see that moment when one leg will lift a memory for life. But Genesis illuminated your path and disrobed your columns and games of sight. Offset you stand to me, elliptic in your stances, as you watch them cast me earless. Our family valerium you pull and scorch my ever-fading history. Four quakes will take to clear our decks of life. Thanks. This one is called January Dew. I'm delighted to say it will be in the next issue of Ciphers in a few weeks' time. So this is January Dew. When grief unbuckled itself, it fell like January dew, seeping right into her very marrow. The big Claire smile was gone. I saw her pass the first riser, head hanging like a wet bulrush, dancing to an air of no confidence. Lonely looking, as if she was already laden with his corpse and marching on the cold terrazzo floor. His stipulate in the year of our Lord was punctual. Christ, hold them as you would a slow air at a flat hole. Cast a safety net over his hill and let it kiss his family. She hears him now as a sleeping fisherman listens to his lapping. Love's
spectral dancing. When he informed us that she was gone, I wished I'd ridden tandem. Return to us, woman, like a welcome scene. Please note a short one here called Mock Barra, my father. He was well placed at the edge of the rounded riser. It would only be a blind Jarvie that would mess with him. I watched him massage the objectus mount of Venus and manoeuvred his Felide turret in the direction of the oncoming traffic. Earlier, he had placed himself in neutral, his inner workings already on their way and pulling him impatiently. Thank you.
I have two poems about the Mount of Venus there, Jean. And nobody knows what the Mount of Venus is, you know?
Is that
it for me, yeah? It's that. It's that part of the hand. It's right there between the thumb and the ring finger. Is that it there?
Yeah.
What? That part. Oh, it's that part. Oh, there you go. It's part of your hand. Yeah. See all that. Next up we have Miriam Casey.
The film. It was raining in the darkness of the morning of unsettling the town of Hill 08. The girl was crying as she stumbled through the cistern of her skin. Water streamed down her face and she looked up occasionally, crying a carry on. With each cry, morning seemed to grow more chilling. And she heard the cry deep and loud within. Marie Marinda, Marie. More pressing than the rhythm of a racing heart. In the distance, she could hear the cries and the sound of sticks against the ground, and she knew that they were drawing nearer. She felt a wholeness within her, and pain struck her like pinpricks on the soles of her feet. She remembered the song that they sang in the village. The bank's so old, my dear, not where you ought to be, and the flood of water's edge, my dear, you do not want to see. She felt herself slipping in the mud. It was getting softer by the minute. The heavy rainfall fell onto her shoulders and onto the sharp rocks. As a child, she had the strangest coloured hair in the village. The girls of her own age had often played with it, tying knots in it and fondling her face in a curious way, saying, "You will find the lock, Sarah." But she hadn't understood at all. The wind shrieked as she felt herself being drawn to the river, a carillon, and she heard in the distance. Was advancing her, and she screamed, wondering what was her fate. Fate? What was fate? Was the time of her first love, when she had felt so strange that she could rise between her legs to stand still, and the uneasy weight that was in the air, women cornered watching her, and the men staring oddly at the ground. Given the threat that seemed to invade her, she rubbed the river and put her hair into it. She crouched by the side and allowed the river to gently hold it in its grasp. It has helped her to deal with the fear rising within her. She had then stepped into it, removed the rags to allow the river to take the blood, and the wind had begun to blow, that there was no one but her, the river, and the wind. From then on, she had often felt the desire rise in her to spend time in her, and listen to the music, for it had been waiting, the music of the beginning, far away from her, and the music that the river taught her rang in her ears, making her aware of things that lay in the wind. That whispered in the grasses, that laboured on the stones, things silent and bare, and she would sit on the bank and wander. And uneasily in the village, she knew that she'd been watched, men looking in their pockets for something, women dressing their hair. And she felt a fear within her, rising each passing day, and she could bear it no longer. She decided to run to the next village, where a girl who had been kind to her lived. She might help her. She spent the night in terror, hoping that no one would see her escape the next morning. At dawn she crept out and began a planned route, but she had not reckoned that it was rain, but they had been waiting. She had reached the border of one field and a shout had risen to the air and the noise of sticks began. She now knew how a deer felt when a bugle was raised to begin a hunt. Her heart felt that it was going to come out. They would catch her on the path. In desperation she looked into the river. At that moment she heard a wail like a lament. "Marie, Marinda?" And her heart jumped in joy. It cut across the rain, holding her in its grip. She felt naked and she wanted to cry, her thoughts that it would not leave her. It pressed to run, and she ran, crying, Akari, Owan. The river, she must get to the river, her friend. It would help her, guide her. The noise of the men was very close now. Suddenly there was a roar as the water came, a wild torrent that took her in its wake, and she heard the sound, Mori Morinda, as far ahead to the standing stone. She made herself ready. Her arm found the stone, and it held her as she heard the cries of the drowned.
Thank you, Miriam. And next up, we have Mr. Alan Tushy.
I always seem to be bringing up the rear, which I hope is not a reflection on anything. I'd like the ballad form. We have some great ballads here tonight, so I decided to write a ballad called A Little Moth. Anybody who's studying literature in UCC or anywhere else, please don't make a Freudian interpretation of this. It's entirely wrong. The Little Moth. I wish I were a little moth with wings of talcum white. I'd flit around your wardrobe and eat your clothes at night. I don't want to be a butterfly with wings sparklingly brilliant, snotsy green, bottle streaky blonde, and highlights of gold gashed vermilion. Just an ordinary plain moth, hopefully even a moth just, going about my feeding business, munching garments or some such. I wish to get inside your wardrobe for nightly things to do, nestle in the garments by John Rocca, find an organza shirt to chew. I cannot say that I'm particular, not especially a bon vivant. I don't differentiate those dumpster knickers from snazzy shoes from Yvonne Saint Laurent. I don't care where you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed, nor the thoughts that there do surround you, as long as I get well fed. On a micromesh baby suit by Versace, an Armani sleeveless satin top, a fine stripped chiffon dress by Zara, or see-through tights from Topshop. Your smelly socks I eat as starters, your underpants I masticate. That special pair you hoard away, but in which you often exaggerate. Your mantle's your lunchbox, hoping for another bite of the sherry, much as I'd like to gobble plimsolls or a blouse that you bought in pennies. Your gown, your flower applique hem, I didn't really want to mention, nor the wrap you brought in Spain. I'm not a dedicated follower of fashion. Just a moth who likes his food, his main course, soup or zoof, who loves the contents of your wardrobe, but doesn't give a fuck for you.
As elusive as he is, we have him on video. And Tempest, he said last week, The Wonder, beautiful poem, at Grogars in English. The video of it is on the O'Hara website, so take a look. Thank you very much. Right, so next week we have Ian Horn, and I'm trying to beat to death this poem, so for God's sake. We want to write the motto that we do. It's an amusing aftertaste, this river of kingly colour. A vain aortic mixture of spirit liquid and ocular delight of pure poetry. It even evolves vampire's overdose on blends of rich thick contradiction of unraveled breaths expired, and even as muses, pilgrim seasoned muses, each leave a trail of purple dripping from tongue and teeth, a new harvest of mystery, and even as poets, starved poets drink. Starved poets drink the mountain manna, purple poem wine, dream drunk poets. Pulse deafens, descends purply, their seasoned lips. Thank you very much.
Thank you.